Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to the show. I am really excited to talk to you today. There has been something on my heart and on my mind that I really wanted to take a few minutes to have a one-on-one with you about. And this is a subject that we're seeing in the news all day, every day. And my producer, Stephanie, said we could talk about this every day and it wouldn't be enough. And parents, I want to talk to you about the mental health of your children. Now, I know that we talk about mental health almost every day in some way, shape, or fashion on the program, but I wanted to go back to basics and review some basic concepts for you. This is a subject that touches every family in some way. You either have a child, a parent, a family member, a friend, someone you know is struggling with mental health. You know someone who has anxiety, who has depression, or other mental health struggles, and that person very well may be you. So I wanted to go back to basics and talk to you about the most common health conditions, mental health conditions, that are facing kids and their families today. And I want to give you some guidance on what you should do about it, and mostly how we can respond to mental health and prevent mental health conditions from occurring. I think one of the most heated debates I'm hearing on this issue is this vast difference between two extremes. We have one extreme that says this generation is a bunch of snowflakes that just need to toughen up. And then we have another extreme that is medicalizing every symptom of anxiety or depression and trying to turn it into a diagnosis. Well, I believe there is a happy medium. So that is our agenda for today. And with that, let's dive in and get started. Now, I want to share with you that I am going to be sharing with you from the book that I wrote for parents. And this mental health crisis is largely what prompted me to write the book that I did. The book that I wrote is called Behind Closed Doors, A Guide to Help Parents and Teens Navigate Through Life's Toughest Issues. And chapter one is about mental health. Now, as we went into the COVID pandemic, I knew as a pediatric care provider for more than 25 years that we had seen a definite shift in pediatric mental health trends. And to be honest with you, there were days I was going to work, even before COVID, where I thought, I don't even recognize my practice. What is this that I'm seeing? Because when I first started practicing, it was things like well child checkups and chicken pox. I even set up a tent every March on the corner outside the clinic so that parents could do drive-bys. And we would take turns standing out there and parents would open the car door. We would say, that's chicken pox and here's what you do. And goodbye. Have a great time watching The Price is Right and eating cinnamon rice. I mean, that is what we did. But really recently, it just seems like I am seeing much more mental health presentation than physical health presentation. And the truth is that the COVID-19 global pandemic really disrupted our behaviors and our norms as a society. Now, you think back to a critical point in every generation has that. You think about the greatest generation who thinks about VE Day, and they still know where they were when that happened. And then we have baby boomers who know where they were when JFK was shot. We have Gen X who know where they were when the Challenger exploded. We have millennials who know where they were on 9/11 and how deeply that impacted their sense of security. But parents, this generation, Generation Z, will look back on the day in March of 2020 that the world shut down, and they will remember where they were during COVID, during quarantine, when the whole world was absolutely terrified. And we already had a generation that was a little stressed out. Millennials were born after 9/11 generally, and they don't view the world as safe. They don't know the world before TSA or security checks in the airport. And so it affects the way that they look at the world. And what we're seeing is a lot of people who don't know what to do. We're having these mental health issues and they kind of go on and on and on until it comes to a point of crisis. And now we're seeing increased presentations of pediatric visits to the emergency room because all of a sudden it has gotten to a point where there is behavior that is literally uncontrollable or it's dangerous to a child or those around them. Now, what we saw was here in the United States, pediatric visits for mental health issues, they increased 31%. From April of 2020 to October of 2020. Now, even if that was just a one-time thing, even though those stressors of COVID are gone, we know that post-traumatic stress disorder is real and the symptoms can linger even from one condition like that, and especially in a pandemic. And we know that there are a lot of contributing factors, and we saw the American Academy of Pediatrics, along with some other organizations, and even the Surgeon General, say we have a crisis of mental health proportions. And I am friends with pediatric care providers all over the world. I have students who are all over the country, and they are telling me, boots on the ground, yes, this is overwhelming. We don't know what to do about this. And there's a lot of disagreement about the cause. It would be very simplistic to say, yeah, it's social media. It's all social media. Social media is definitely a contributor to the mental health crises that we're seeing today. But again, it would be overly simplistic to blame it all on that. And there are a lot of factors surrounding that that change the way that we are interacting in person. So even think about Generation Z. They have something today called order anxiety. Like, this is a term that they use very commonly in everyday conversation. And what it means is that I don't want to walk up to the counter of a restaurant anywhere and actually have to give my order in person. You can watch a lot of funny, really, they are funny, TikTok videos or Instagram reels where people are practicing, young people are practicing this order over and over before they walk up to the counter. And then they walk up to the counter and they say, blah, 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 and they can't speak because they're so used to having digital interactions. Now, this is where it's really important for us as parents, as grandparents in another generation, to teach today's kids those old school social skills. Now, we know how to do that because we know a world without smartphones. We know what it's like for the phone line to be busy for a long time. And so you just go over and knock on the door. In today's generation, if someone knocks on the door, it can send a young person into a panic. Why are they here? Why didn't they call? Why didn't they text first? What are they doing? Just showing up here like a total psycho is what the conversation is that you will hear. And so those things are true. And when we have those generational changes, those technological influences, then we add in all of these societal changes that COVID-19 brought, school closures or impacts on having sports or after-school activities or changing their parents' job or their economic situation. And the overarching factor that was in COVID that deeply impacted our kids was the fear of the unknown, because we couldn't answer their questions as parents of what's going to happen. Am I going to be able to go to college? I don't know. Am I going to be able to go back to school? I don't know. What's the world going to look like next year? I don't know. And those things are very, very frightening. And when we are trying to guide our kids, they want to know that we know what's happening, but the truth is that we just don't know. And I can share this story with you on a personal level because I think as parents, it's very difficult for us to see a mental health condition in our kids. And in behind closed doors, I share personal stories, clinical stories, stories from my clinical practice about patients I've encountered so that you can see how all of these psychosocial issues present themselves physically in my clinic. And I'll share that with you. Let me share the story that opens up chapter one from my clinical practice. Worry clouded a mother's eyes in an exam room with her 8-year-old daughter. Noticeably small in stature, this frail girl with wide blue eyes climbed quietly onto her mother's lap. Her oversized, cheerfully perched hair bow created a stark contrast to her somber expression. The family experienced a significant health scare when this cherub was diagnosed with a severe immune disorder before her first birthday. A long procession of specialist visits, hospital stays, painful tests, scary nights of high fevers, and many tears overshadowed her first 7 years of life before getting the good news that she was one of the few who were fortunate to outgrow her condition. Her family was guardedly optimistic about reentry into a semi-normal life after living through years of restrictions. That's why this Christmas, this little girl was beyond excited to go to a birthday party at an American Girl store. With eager anticipation, she wore festive party dress, shiny patent leather shoes, and her trademark, impossibly large hair bow. In the middle of the party, as the girl presented her gift, she started having trouble breathing, and it rapidly worsened. Her mother panicked and gave her an asthma rescue inhaler, and it helped a little, but not enough. A devastated little girl and a horrified mother abruptly left the party to speed to their pediatrician. When they got there, she looked fine. They scratched their heads, worrying about any sign that the immune deficiency was returning. It took years to diagnose. It was anxiety? Now, friends, the thing that you don't know is this serious little girl is my little girl. And the worried mother is me. Now, yes, I'm an expert and seasoned pediatric nurse practitioner, but parents, let's agree, it's difficult to be objective with our own kids. Our emotional investment clouds our rational thought, and we just say, yeah, but this is my baby. My husband will do this with me, and I will lose my mind over talking through some health issue with my kids. And he'll say, okay, honey, let's pretend play, call the nurse practitioner, and I'll give him advice. But when it's my child, it's different. And the truth is, parents, this is a tough truth. We intensely fear fatal injuries or debilitating diseases like cancer for our kids, but we don't fear things like depression or anxiety, because those seem less scary, and frankly, they seem like something we can control. So it took me a long time to recognize the physical symptoms that my daughter was having. And the truth is, the way that our brain processes trauma and stressors manifests itself through very real physical symptoms. And even so, even if your healthcare provider brings this up and says, well, this is anxiety or depression, if we're really honest, we kind of feel this mixture of relief, and then we start to feel some skepticism, and then if we're really honest, we kind of feel annoyed. Our secret inner monologue as parents says, okay, is this real? Is this for attention? Okay, so this isn't really a big deal. And we want that healthcare provider to pull out a rapid anxiety test like a rapid strep test. And then we want a quick fix, like the pink stuff fixes strep. And as parents, we treat issues of mental health much differently than physical health. And I'll share with you how we do that when we come back. We have a lot more to talk about. I'm going to give you some insight to the shame and stigma that surrounds mental health conditions. We'll talk about anxiety and depression, and we'll talk about what kind of mental health care provider might be right for your child and how to find and connect to that service. This is a really important conversation impacting someone you know, and that someone might be you. We're here to provide hope and prescribe hope for healthy families. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. Daisy and her husband had decided they never wanted kids. And when she found out she was pregnant, she immediately thought abortion. But after she and her husband met her baby on ultrasound and heard the heartbeat, their hearts melted and they chose life. Her baby Jeffrey is healthy and beautiful, and Daisy and her husband can't even imagine life without him. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles a baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends, to this really important conversation that we're having one-on-one today. It's just me and you, and we're talking about mental health. Now, this is continuing to be an ongoing issue that I can assure you is very real. And many times when I'm in the media, I'm asked, is it as bad as people are saying it is? And as a nurse, it's important for me to be honest, and I have to say, no, it's not as bad as people are saying it is. It's worse. But there is hope in that, and I hope to provide that for you. Now, we were talking about the impacts of COVID, and some interesting research shows that in other traumatic events and geosocial events that happen, we have studied looking at how that impacts kids. And so one interesting study that I found looked at Hurricane Ike, which was a big hurricane that came through about a decade ago here in Galveston in Texas. And when we looked at the trauma response from kids just from Hurricane Ike, which many of you probably wouldn't even remember, you think about Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Andrew. Ike is not usually up there on the list, but even a hurricane like this, what the researchers saw was symptoms presenting of anxiety and trauma response and depression in children for up to 15 months after the event. And I think we have to remember that we are not superhuman. We are very human, with human frailty and human emotions. And it's normal to need some time to process things like that. And the other thing that's really hard for parents is that when we start seeing signs of anxiety and depression, many times for kids, it presents as behavioral issues. Now, if you're an adult, you're likely going to be more aware that you're experiencing signs of anxiety or depression, and you can even ask yourself that question and be able to articulate that. But if you're a kid, you don't have that kind of awareness. You just know that you're feeling off. And so there are behavioral manifestations that happen. For little kids, it can be regression of milestones. Maybe they were potty trained, but now they're having accidents, or maybe they were sleeping really well, and now they're not sleeping. And for kids and teenagers, it can come across like inattentiveness and forgetfulness and not paying attention. And for older kids, it can come across like anxiety, like anger. It can come across as rebellious attitudes. And we immediately as parents start thinking of those things as behavioral issues, when really they can be cries for help. They can be signals that your body is giving to say, my body is working really hard to process trauma through my brain. Now, I want to give you a metaphor that I use a lot to talk to parents. As parents, imagine this scenario. Imagine that your child's teacher calls and says, hey, I think that your kid is having trouble seeing the board at school. We've tried moving them closer, but they're saying it's blurry and they have a headache, and I think you should go get it checked. Well, you probably wouldn't even have hung up the phone before you're on the phone again texting or calling your optometrist to schedule an appointment. And if you're told that your child is nearsighted and needs glasses, then you excitedly choose flattering frames and you affirm their choice. In today's day and age, you're grateful that glasses are cool and you compliment their appearance, and probably you're going to post about it on social media and say, "Look who got glasses." And then you're going to follow up with the teacher to make sure everything's better and ask your kid, "Okay, is everything better? Can you see?" Now, I want you to think with me about a different ending. Say that story starts the same way. Your teacher calls you, but instead of calling him an optometrist, you tell your teen, "You're probably not getting enough sleep. We should just wait and see how this is." And you're resistant to the teacher. And you say, "You know, I really am upset that you are saying this about my child. And maybe you don't know them well enough, but they're a good kid and you shouldn't be saying this about their eyes." And you start to foster maybe even some animosity towards the teacher. And predictably, it gets worse. And you decide, "Okay, maybe it's diet related. Let's try gluten-free everything." And that doesn't help. So you buy some vitamin supplements, you do some internet searching, you argue with your spouse or your mom about it. Now it's been 6 months and the teacher is calling and the grades are dropping, and you finally go to the optometrist really begrudgingly, and they say, "Okay, your child is nearsighted and they need glasses." And you say, "Thank you, but I think we're going to get a second opinion." And you start to wonder, "What is wrong with my faith? Why can't I believe that my child will see and no longer need glasses? Why can't I just pull myself together and be a better parent so that my child won't have this problem?" Now, I know this may seem ridiculous, but here's the kicker. This is what we do with mental health. And parents, I'm being very honest and transparent with you, having been that parent myself and having been the provider on the other side. This is what I see parents doing with mental health issues. As soon as it's brought up, we think, "No, that can't be my child. Let me try all of these things." And then by the time goes by, you're looking at it singularly as a parenting issue or a faith issue, when it can be a real issue of your body working to process stressors and trauma. Now, when we look at even before COVID-19, there were 8 million children who had a recognized mental health disorder. Now, there are a lot of kids who face a lot of traumatic events. They face divorce. They face death of a loved one. They face moving. Some of those stressors we can control, and some of them we absolutely can't. And research shows that experiencing 4 or more significant adverse childhood experiences, which we call ACEs, increases the likelihood of a mental health condition that rises to the level of being diagnosed. Now, the opposite is true, though, that even though kids experience stressors, if they have meaningful connection to an adult who is supportive in their life, those things can foster resilience despite the stress. But even before COVID, 1 in 3 high school students reported feeling sad and hopeless most of the time. Now, that's a 40% increase from the previous decade. And the thing that's really sobering is that only about half of children diagnosed with a mental health condition actually do receive treatment. And I do see mental health crises skyrocketing, especially among teens, but we're seeing it younger and younger and younger. And we're seeing self-harming behaviors and suicidal behaviors. Now, teens with untreated mental health conditions are more likely to engage in risk-taking behaviors, including unhealthy sexual activity, alcohol consumption, drug use, and acts of violence. Two of the most common things that we see today are depression and anxiety. Now, hear me clearly, parents. This is why early intervention is so important, because recognizing signs and symptoms of depression, anxiety early and intervening early, that has the best outcome. But we have to overcome that barrier of being willing to say this is happening. Now, depression is a serious mental health concern. It's a leading cause of disability for teenagers aged 15 to 19 years. And it does impact about 17% of teenagers. Now, depression is complex in its cause. You have alterations in brain chemistry. We can have hormone imbalance. We can have inherited genetic traits where it runs in families. You can be influenced by early childhood trauma or learned patterns of harmful thinking. And teens with depression often initially show irritability. Irritability is one of the earliest signs of depression. They are self-critical. They feel genuinely unworthy of joy in life and love from others. And they avoid situations that require energy to pretend things are normal because their body is already depleted. They often will hide, but that makes them feel worse. And depression does easily mimic a physical illness. So usually what I'll see in my practice is teens who come in thinking they have mono, or they have the flu, or COVID, because they're having altered sleep patterns, or weight changes, or fatigue. Other common physical complaints that I see are headaches, stomach aches, vomiting, diarrhea, back pain. All of these things can happen, and you start to lose the love for things you once enjoyed. There may be lower grades at school. They may avoid other people, or they may have some self-harming behaviors. Now, anxiety is something that everyone experiences at some point, and it is an effective temporary coping tool. It alerts our bodies that something is wrong so that we can take protective actions. And in that way, anxious feelings are healthy. It helps us identify danger, and then our body mounts this miraculous fight or flight response. And in healthy circumstances, anxiety can help us to perform tasks better, thinking about getting pumped up for the big game or stimulating creativity, like working on a project with a deadline. When you feel anxious, your body is going to naturally respond by increasing your heart rate, increasing your blood pressure, dilating your pupils, and shaking. I mean, you've all been there. Public speaking or skydiving or little dogs barking. Okay, well, that's just me. Sorry. But usually this on-edge feeling goes away very quickly. But teenagers with anxiety experience these symptoms in a prolonged fashion. So it goes on, and it doesn't go away when you remove that stressful stimulus. And so there are different kinds of anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder. That's feeling anxious, but you don't really have a trigger and you don't know why. There's obsessive compulsive disorder or panic attacks. Now, if you've ever seen anyone with a panic attack, it looks scary. It looks like they're having a heart attack or a stroke or something really scary. And those physical symptoms are real. God made our bodies to respond in that way to anxiety, but sometimes that anxiety response is uncontrolled. And again, it can be because of a complex interaction of factors. And I think the reason that we have a hard time saying our kids have anxiety or depression is because stigma and bias are really real. And as I told you, it took me almost 2 years to realize my daughter was having panic attacks. That episode that we had at the birthday party was a panic attack. And here, my maternal bias just prevented me from seeing it. And, you know, there was one time where we were at a camp together, my daughter and I was the camp nurse, and this was after I already realized that she was having post-traumatic stress from an illness that she had had when she was young. And it was a very traumatic medical experience that she had, and we didn't recognize that as post-traumatic stress. And one day she was having a panic attack at the camp, and so she comes running into my office, runs past me, goes to my room, locks the door, and is hiding on the floor. And her little friends come running after that, and they were really afraid, thinking that they had hurt her feelings. They had no idea what had happened, and they were a little scared. And my daughter was begging me, "Don't tell them, don't tell them." And in that moment, I feel like the Lord opened my eyes to see my daughter in desperate need. She was lonely, she was terrified, she was crying. And on the other side of the door was grace and love and understanding and support. But she had chosen to lock herself away and suffer alone. Now, of course, she did this as a child who couldn't understand that, but I could see that as her mom. So I invited the friends in, and I simply explained that their friend has anxiety. I told them sometimes she feels scared for no reason, and when that happens, she just needs to know that everything is going to be okay. I said it helps if you give her a little physical space, but stay there with her, speak calmly, reassure her, pray for her, speak scriptures over her, tell her they love her, and get a trusted adult. That worked wonders. My daughter was no longer embarrassed, and her friends now had a serious mission. They were educated, they were empowered, they knew what was happening, what to do about it, and when to get help. And so that is important. Now, let's talk some nuts and bolts about what to do if you think that your child is having a mental health condition. And I want to give this disclaimer here that any advice that I'm giving today is just general medical advice. Each of your children are wonderfully unique, and each of your situations are unique. And if you are experiencing this in a personal way, I strongly encourage you, and I do advise you, to seek consultation from a professional healthcare provider who can help evaluate your situation and give you advice for how to treat it. But the first and foremost thing is safety. So any life-threatening emergencies warranting a call to 911 include suicidal intent, threats or acts of violence, or any other life-threatening safety risk. Any report of physical or sexual abuse should be reported immediately to a licensed healthcare provider, to Child Protective Services, and to local law enforcement. And so I feel like I need to say that just to be clear. And parents will ask, when should I be concerned? How do I know when my child is experiencing something with their mental health that needs help? And I want to tell you, parents, that you know already, because you know your child. And when it comes to the level that you're thinking about it all the time, that it is disrupting your family norms, that it is impacting and altering your behaviors, that you're going places separately now because you're trying to moderate or modify your behavior to accommodate that disability that's coming from those feelings of anxiety or depression, that is time. That means it's time to get some help, and it's time to do something about it. I'll talk about what that looks like, what you can expect in a healthcare visit, and what the common treatments are. We'll continue prescribing hope for healthy families on the other side of this break. Don't go away.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to this really critical conversation about mental health. We are working together to try to respond to kids in this generation who are experiencing mental health crises of unprecedented proportions, and how we can be help and hope in that. Now, before in the first two segments, I've talked to you about what mental health is, what the common things are that kids face, although there are a lot of other things that can face it, but we're just looking at kind of mental health 101. And I want to talk to you in this last segment about what you should do and the road that you should expect. The first thing that I will tell you is anytime you're facing mental health conditions, it is usually going to be a long road with no easy fix. You have to have patience for the journey. I referenced before, we want the pink stuff like we do for strep, and we want our kids to be feeling better the next day. We don't want to see our kids unable to participate in the things that they once enjoyed. But we really have to have some patience for that. And when we're considering these things with our kids, when we start to see that they're experiencing symptoms of anxiety or depression, listen, that does not mean that they have a diagnosable disorder. It means they're having some unhealthy coping emotions that we can stop and respond to. And the earlier that we do it with coping tools, the better. So when your child comes to you, and even if they're older and they can verbalize to you, "I'm wondering if I have anxiety or depression." Listen, especially for teenagers, they are surrounded by TikTok influencers and Instagram reels that are telling them, "Oh, this is anxiety or this is depression." And that's a common question that I get from teens is, "Do I have anxiety or do I have depression?" And that can be where a healthcare provider can help you sort that out and figure out, is this just an anxious feeling or a depressed feeling, or does this rise to the level of a diagnosable disorder? So resist the urge to be dismissive and normalize these feelings as indications that you need to see a healthcare provider, just like you would if your teen reported a sore throat or a fever, and say, "Hey, well, let's go get that checked out." That's really important. The next critical step is finding a primary healthcare provider that both you and your child trust, and more importantly, that you like. You remember baby immunizations or ear infections or well baby checks? Those same providers do see kids across the lifespan who have mental health issues. Now, pediatric providers generally see kids through age 21. Give or take a little bit. We are generally going to see kids through college because they may go to college and then they haven't had time to establish with an adult healthcare provider. So I will often see kids when they're home from college or as they're going through trade school or through those early stages of adult development. So it's important to find a provider that your kids are connected to. Now, sometimes people will ask me, when should they stop seeing a pediatric care provider? Well, that just depends on the relationship that you have with yours. If your child is not particularly connected to their pediatric care provider and sitting in the waiting room full of blocks and screaming kids and baby diapers makes them feel like this is not the place for me, then it may be time to find a family or adult care provider when they reach those teen years. Now, the most common pediatric care providers that you will see that are just generally providing care for kids will be a pediatrician who is a medical doctor with a doctoral degree and specialty training and board certification in pediatrics, or a pediatric nurse practitioner in primary care like myself. This is a master's or doctoral degree prepared nurse with, again, national certification in pediatrics. Now, if you're looking at mental health care providers, there are some different options. There are some nurse practitioners who have a certification called PMHS. Now, that is Primary Care Mental Health Specialist. So these are nurse practitioners who have had additional training specifically in issues of mental health, and it's a certification that they get. They can be in primary care or they can be in a specialty office. And then you have a different kind of nurse practitioner that is a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. Now, the difference between those two certifications is that the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner has certification across the lifespan. So they can see children all the way through adults. They also see adults. And again, that's a master's or doctoral degree prepared nurse with state licensure and national certification. Other providers who also provide mental health care services are professional child counselors or therapists, and those credentials can vary according to discipline and state, and there is some state variation in the title protection or the license that they have, but most of them have a focus on child and adolescent development. And then there are child psychologists. Now, this is a master's or doctoral degree in child psychology, and they can be in a lot of different care settings, and they're going to provide a variety of services to children that they don't prescribe. So this is a non-prescribing provider. And then you have all the way to child psychiatrist, which is a medical doctor, board certified in general psychiatry, and then followed by training and board certification in child psychiatry. And so they have some, they see patients all across the pediatric lifespan, and they are especially equipped to deal with complex or severe behavioral and mental health concerns. They are usually highly specialized and they do prescribe. So you, especially for really complex things like schizophrenia, you're going to probably need the assistance of a child psychiatrist to help manage that. Now, I know there are very strong feelings across the board about all of these care providers and where they fit in the context of a Christian worldview. And I would encourage you that this does not happen in a singular plane, responding to your child's mental health conditions. You generally are going to need a team of people. And I encourage you to pray about finding the right people to connect to. And that, again, is why I think it's so important to have a connection to a primary care provider that you know and trust, who can help you navigate those connections and know what is the right choice for your particular family. Now, and your situation. Now, when you go, usually what's going to happen for any of these providers is that they're going to start out with some questionnaires. One of the common ones used is called the Patient Health Questionnaire 9, or the PHQ-9. This is basically a simple 9-question screening tool about things like sleeping and eating and feeling down or hopeless. We have a similar scale for anxiety, depression, suicidality, and we'll be able to tell pretty early on, okay, mom, okay, dad, this is something that we really need to be concerned about. It looks like your child is having some severe symptoms. So let's see if that rises to the level of a diagnosis and what to do about that. Or conversely, we could say, you know what? This looks like a little bump in the road. And I think with a few coping skills, a few adjustments in your lifestyle, we'll be able to take care of this right here. And so that's really important. A quote from Martin Luther King Jr. that I love says, "You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step." So as parents, a lot of us, and me included, we have a fear of voicing any of those symptoms of mental health concerns because we think as soon as we say that, they're going to diagnose my child and they're going to pressure me immediately to take medication. I'm here to tell you that is not how an encounter for mental health concerns should happen. Evaluation is going to take a stepwise approach. So if your child has symptoms, this is what your provider should do. This is what you could expect. First of all, to make sure there is no safety threat to themselves or others. And sometimes I will tell you, parents, when they come in, when families come in, we might uncover suicidal thoughts that have not been voiced before. And so that's part of our role, is to make sure that your child is safe and to help you ensure that. Our second job is to carefully rule out any physical problems. Sometimes there can be very real blood sugar issues or other endocrine or organ system issues that are causing symptoms that are like mental health. So we can't just assume first that it's mental health. We want to make sure there are no physical problems. Then we're going to introduce that questionnaire to see if we can identify some mental health concerns. And these questionnaires that we use have been used and validated on literally millions of children. And so we know what we're looking for. Then we'll decide, are there some labs that needed to be ordered or other tests that need to be run? And then at that point, we'll decide, can the issue be handled in primary care or do you need a specialist? And then we'll start to discuss some treatment options. Now, before I get to treatment, I want to tell you the best thing that parents can do today is actually prevention. Now, this might sound overly simplistic, but these things are simple, but they're not easy to do, and they are often neglected by busy families who are just trying to plan dinner and keep life together. Now, I'm a guilty mom right here. unpredictability really increases stress. And for the last 4 years especially, I think there is no better word to describe life than unpredictable. So what we can do as parents and families is to do our best to keep a routine schedule. Now, that doesn't have to be very legalistic and very prescribed, and it can look different for each family. So for my family, for example, routine means we're going to eat together most nights, even if that's peanut butter sandwiches while we're standing around the kitchen island, or if we're eating sandwiches on the go in the car on the way to a sports game. We're going to eat together and we're going to ask each other about the highs and the lows and the where did you goes and the tell me about your day. We also talk about bedtime having a rhythm. I talked on the show about that last week, and our healthy habits for parenting and bedtime routine is important. Now, for me, I still read out loud to my kids. I pray with them every night. I ask them, how can I pray for you? And we talk about their day. And there are different little things for each kid that they like having done. And we try to do those routines. And it doesn't matter if they're toddlers or teenagers, or adults, frankly, we all need a bedtime routine. And I think that one of the important things to remember here is that we have to give without expectation of response. So it's not like our kids are going to say, hey, mom and dad, you're doing such a great job maintaining routine and giving me stability and having me feel less anxious. Good job. Like, they don't do that. But we have to recognize that we are the parent. And we can't expect instant gratification from our children. It is not their purpose in life to give us validation for our parenting choices. That is not their job. In other things of prevention, the importance of sleep cannot be overemphasized. And again, we're talking about that in our habits for healthy parenting, sleep hygiene, and bedtime routine. Kids need a comfortable, safe, peaceful place to sleep and almost always need more sleep than they're getting. Children often eat and sleep and study and have screen time, and their dirty, rumpled bed that's filled with chip crumbs or goldfish or dirty clothes, and their bodies don't experience physical fatigue because we're not active enough. And for teenagers especially, that can lead to mindless phone scrolling at night and disrupting their sleep cycle. They can't sleep. They wake up, they look at their phone, and they see, oh, it's 2 a.m. Oh, I missed a notification. The next thing you know, they're watching 3 hours of cat videos. Like, why? This is what happens. So having your phone outside your room, having any screens outside the bedroom, is one of the best things that you can do to impact your mental health. Exercising at least an hour a day promotes a healthy sleep cycle, and it positively impacts mental, emotional, and physical health. So those things are really important to do for prevention. What we eat, what we sleep, how we sleep, and what we're doing for activity. Though looking at those three things can be helpful. Now, going back to therapies, I want to emphasize that even if your child is diagnosed with anxiety or depression, if it's mild, almost always it can be treated without medication, and that can at least be a first step. Mental health therapies like counseling or cognitive behavioral therapy or behavioral management are really ideal for mild symptoms of anxiety or depression. They're safe, they're effective, they don't involve medications, but it takes time. And it can be challenging to find a qualified provider that you're connected to. That can be expensive, and it requires dedication to regular visits. That may mean you miss work, but if you do that, if you invest in the mental health of your child, it will pay dividends. And so the takeaways from today's program are: mental health conditions are common. They are impacting kids today. But there are things that we can do as parents to help. We can develop healthy habits. And I invite you to join in our journey to develop 52 habits for healthy parenting. All of these things that we've talked about so far positively impact mental health. So if you're wanting to improve your mental health, one of the first things that you can do is jump in on that journey. Just listen here. Every week we'll be introducing a new habit for healthy parenting. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.